Welcome to Connecting the Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea, speaking to you from a magical far-off land called Seattle. And we are here today on this beautiful Thursday, as we're here every day, Monday through Friday, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And it being Thursday, we are here today with my Thursday co-host, Mr. Doug O'Brien. How you doing, Doug?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Mark.
Well, that's cool. What you been up to?
Oh, work.
Yeah, me too. Guys, did you, I thought, well, before we do anything else, I figure I'll throw the phone number out for all of those out there in radio land or streaming land, as it really is. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And you can also text us at that number, or you can tweet us at Breadbox Media. I thought it might be fun. This is more the this show. The Thursday show generally tends to be about faith in the public square, since that's kind of your wheelhouse. And so this last Monday was the. The most watched debate in the history of the United States was this past Monday.
Yes.
And it was treated by the networks like the Super Bowl. It was weird. Yes. To watch all these kind of sports motifs, you know, just blatantly trotted out. You practically expected to see them with like the dark smudges under their eyes or something.
Well, there was something going on.
Yeah, it was weird. Like, you know, you just kind of wanted to see Hillary in dreadlocks or something, you know, with like some tattoo. You know? But yeah, it was just hilarious. I did not get a chance to see the debate when it was happening live, because I was doing something really important, which was having my granddaughters over. And as well as nieces and kids, but I like caught up on all the debate stuff afterwards. And did you get a chance to see it?
I did. I was in a funny situation. I was attending a dinner for the 10th anniversary of the Global Food Banking Network. And they do incredible work around the globe, especially in emerging markets. And most of the people in the room left very quickly as soon as the event ended to retreat to the bar, where we watched the debate with closed caption underneath. And of course, on the other screen was a baseball game that no one really cared about. And so I didn't really get to hear a lot of it. I did the next day, but I read it and watched it, and you could see the nonverbal cues that many of them were, that both of them were giving off. And it's a fascinating thing.
You know, I think perhaps one of the most thankless jobs on planet Earth would have to be the person that has to take down the verbal linguine that comes out of Trump's mouth in real time. and put it on a
great feed. Huge, big, beautiful.
It's just because, you know, it was funny. I mean, I actually saw somebody simply reading one of the spaghetti against the wall blats that came out of Trump's mouth about something or other. I think it was his remarks on cybersecurity.
Oh, yes.
Which were like, it was something about cybersecurity, and then he sort of rambled off toward his 10-year-old kid who knows how to use a computer. And it was like, are you kidding me? I mean,
yeah, the whole wow. He refers to the internet and the web as cyber, and the whole thing was just, yeah.
The cyber, yeah.
Yeah, the cyber.
Yeah, he just sounds like your drunk uncle who's like never picked up a cell phone. Or never turned on a computer, because how do these things work? I don't understand it. You know, I have people to take care of these things. You know. But anyway, I guess I just want to get your general impressions of the thing.
Well, I think like a lot of people, my takeaway was the first 15 to maybe 20 minutes of the debate. I came in just a little bit late after their opening statements, but he did, I thought, a very good job in the very beginning, actually substantively addressing an issue that is, I think, an Achilles heel for Hillary Clinton, and that is the issue of trade and jobs and generally the economy. Mm-hmm. And then it shifted, and it pretty much was downhill from that moment on.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, it was actually, even though the sound was not on, it was hard to watch. Mm-hmm. And when I saw it the next day, with sound, kind of the rambling answers that I think the poignant thing that came out for me was the statement by Hillary Clinton that when she claimed he didn't have stamina, and if he said stamina one more time, I was going to throw my shoe at the television.
But it's a how should you put it? It's a Freudianly loaded term, I think, for that guy.
I think you might be right. But she said that, yes, I took time off to prepare for this debate, and what else I prepared to be was president of the United States. And to me, that summed up the debate perfectly, which right. is that she, as much as I may not like her or I disagree vehemently with her policies, mm-hmm. she is prepared, and she has prepared for this. Right. And he showed he was you know, that dream that at least I've had, where you wake up and you're taking a major test and you didn't study for it. You didn't feel it was going to take place. That panic you go through.
Right.
You know, and you think, can I guess my way through this? And you know, and it's math. And no, you can't. No, it's a mess. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, she came off for me. I'm the same way. I have profound disagreements with her on a number of points. I deeply disagree with her on abortion. I disagree with her on gay marriage, although that train has left the station with the Supreme Court. You know, I disagree with her deeply on her lickspittle, spaniel-like devotion to the 1%.
Yeah.
And she is a member of the 1%, you know. And I disagree with her on her hawkishness. But at the end of the day, she was the only adult up there. He right. just was not an adult. I mean, he didn't act like an adult. He acted like all I could think of, because she was hyper prepared, you know. And my summation when I was talking to a friend of it was, this was Biff Tannen versus Hermione Granger. I mean, right. you know, she just, any question that anybody in that auditorium, if they'd open it up from the audience, you know, she would have been the one, you know, just with her hand shot up, you know, ready to answer every question. And Trump would have been this, you know, rambling guy who it was very clear as time went on, after about the 30-minute mark, this is a guy who's out of his element, who's blustering his way through, you know, blustering his way through the test, you know, and bragging about himself. But his brags were telling, you know, he bragged about paying no taxes.
Yeah, that was, yeah.
But the thing is, of course, for his base, that's a win.
Yeah, but I wonder if his base was quite as enthusiastic about learning that he received a $14 million loan from his father to start his business, because I think, you know, overwhelmingly none of us get that that benefit, you know, and that really does it's kind of hard, you know, there's no Horatio Alger story here, that's for sure.
And
you know, the thing is, and if the first, you know, we'll say half hour of the 90-minute debate was Trump doing well, you know, Clinton does have a whole host of, and I don't mean the scandals, because that is just gutter politics, and I think no one cares, I think, at this point, about Bill Clinton's infidelities, right?
Right, but
there are other issues, and you know, my retort to the tax, releasing taxes, would be, I'll release my taxes, we'll release your Wall Street speeches, because I think Hillary Clinton is just as frightened to release her Wall Street speeches as Donald Trump is adamant to not release his taxes.
Well, and in fact, I think he actually used that line,
kind of.
Right.
Oh, no, okay.
I mean, just to say, I mean, there are just a whole host of things that she could, that he could, if he actually prepared, just spent some time preparing to justify that he should occupy the Oval Office.
Right.
But instead, what we got was further proof he should not even visit the Oval Office.
Right. Well, and it was a very kind of, you got the sense that this was a stream of consciousness. I've seen. Oh, well, we'll talk about this when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Doug O'Brien, talking about the debate, and we will be back on Connecting the Dots right after this.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
The Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with none other than Monsieur Douglas O'Brien. Monsieur sounds pretty cool. Sorry. anyway, we've been talking about the debates earlier this week. There's the first of three. And if you want to join us, please give us a call. We're at 1-573-4BREAD-4, 1-573-4BREAD-4. You can also text us at 1-573-4BREAD-4, and you can tweet us at Breadbox Media. What struck me was, and I've been seeing stories like this getting to the New York Times, and the only way these stories can get to the New York Times is if Trump's staffers are leaking them to the New York Times. That's how this has to get out. And the stories are basically chronicling the exasperation of Trump staffers saying he just won't prepare. He can't be bothered. They keep trying to get him to learn some content so he knows what he's talking about, and flying by the seat of my pants and stream of consciousness stuff has worked really well throughout the primary, which is true, because the primaries, of course, were about shoring up the base. And so if you're talking to a big, giant crowd of people who all adore you and roar every time you shout Crooked Hillary and make up crazy stuff about, Obama founding ISIS and believe all that, that will work really well if you're talking to giant crowds of true believers. But it doesn't. None of that works when you're actually talking to, the rest of the American people who are like, no, Obama didn't found ISIS, and talk like a grown-up. So he's kind of a victim of his own success. The things that worked for him during the primaries didn't work for him in this debate. And so he came across, he's used to being able to say unchallenged crazy things that are totally out of touch with reality, like Obama founded ISIS. And he did that during the debate, so at one point he declared to Hillary in one of his many interruptions that this is why you have been fighting ISIS all your adult life, which was just a lunatic thing to say in public to rational adults. I mean, she was born in 1947. She's, what, 68 years old, 69 years old. And ISIS was founded in 2013. And you have to have the historical memory of a fruit fly to believe a crazy thing like that.
But, well, I mean, that along those lines, I mean, he really showed a lack of even rudimentary knowledge of things that you would want someone who was in the Oval. I don't mean even foreign affairs. I'm just talking about domestic policy. Right. And it seriously, I have a drunk uncle who knows more about this stuff than Donald Trump. And you really come back to, I don't know if he's not serious about this or he lacks the ability to focus that way. I mean, you know, the story for the last 2 days has been Miss Universe and the really awful things he says about women generally, right? Right. And it's kind of unfortunate because that again breaks us into, you know, gender identity politics and all weight shame and all kind of stuff. When in reality, if we just thought about the debate itself, I think most people, especially his most ardent supporters, would have to say that the debate was just an abject failure by him.
It was a debacle. But that's the thing. You know, you ask, and a lot of people ask this. You know, I ask it. So you look at it, you think, is he serious? I mean, what's he doing? You know,
right?
Is this like some game for him or what? And so you get, and so it results in all these, like, you know, conspiracy theories that, you know, he was hired by Hillary to run for president in order to make sure that she would win. And I've seen people, you know, who seriously have those theories going on. But, you know, I keep coming back to, you know, it seems to me to just be an issue of character. What kind of man is Donald Trump?
Right.
And Donald Trump is a man who has his entire life been totally cocooned from consequences of his actions by money and power. Mm-hmm. And that has an effect on a person. And you can really never develop the skills for being able to, for example, cope with reality. I mentioned this on a blog the other day. You know, little children will do odd things that, you know, adults look at them and think you can't be serious. But of course, they've got their developing brains going on. So I got a 2-year-old niece or a granddaughter, I mean, and she, you know, she's at that age where if she, like, covers herself up under a blanket, she really thinks that she can't be seen. And there's, like, the whole phenomenon of, like, object permanence where, you know, I don't want to eat these lima beans, so I'll scrape them off the plate onto the floor and then say that I ate the lima beans. And when you point out the lima beans that are still on the floor, they'll get angry. Because, no, I ate the lima beans. This is my reality now. And I've told myself this, and this is what I want to believe. And so it's a sort of a magical thinking, that I can make reality conform to my will simply by declaring something to be so. And so Trump, after the debate, you know, when he was beaten so bad, it's not possible for Trump to just simply have lost. So there must be a conspiracy that somehow cheated him of victory. And so the next day he's on the air and there are two things that are on his mind. One of them is talking about a woman being fat. He has to find some woman that he can beat up publicly by calling her fat and insulting her and all the rest of it. And the other thing that was absolutely vital was to claim to 80 million people who heard every word he said last night that the microphone had been tampered with.
Yeah.
And it's like, then why could we hear you? And it really is, it's remarkably childish. Go ahead.
It is. And, you know, and the other thing, too, is that, you know, one of the things that is really important in campaigns and electoral politics generally is to have you want the principal or the politician to be liked. Right. And one of the other things beyond just the complete and utter lack of substance was that he came across as someone that you really don't want to have a beer with. Right. he's someone that if he was your neighbor, you would be concerned about the kids running on his lawn or the dog getting out. You know what I'm saying? Is it?
Right. Yeah.
And so I think, you know, he had some upward traction in the polls. In a number of places, he was tied, especially in battleground states like Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. He was statistically tied with Hillary Clinton. I'm looking forward to seeing, and I don't mean these crazy internet polls. I mean legitimate scientific polling data that shows how much he actually suffered. Because I really think, and I don't just mean among undecided voters, of which there seems to be many fewer than in past years, but even among his supporters, how many he may have lost, because it was just, it really was a train wreck of a debate for him.
Well, I'm looking at Nate Silver's site right now, and it was funny because the day after the debate, she dropped 5 points. I was stunned. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, that may have been, I don't think that was, I mean, truly a post-debate poll. People have had a chance, you know what I'm saying?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Immediately after the debate, she dropped 5 points. She's now up. She's now at 63%. She was before the debate. She was at about 61%. So she's just had a hell of a post-debate bounce.
About positive bounce, right.
Positive bounce, which was what I was expecting immediately after the debate. But apparently, it took a while for people to kind of digest it. And perhaps, you know, part of it is watching Trump digest it. And Trump, he has come unhinged. I mean, of all the things that you could talk about after that debate, Miss Universe is what he fixated on.
Yeah.
And it's like, really? You know, that's it, you know? And now his big issue is he's furious with friends and allies who are telling him that he lost the debate. Because again, you know, I am under this blanket. What do you mean you can? What do you mean you can see me? Right? That's not possible. and you know, I was talking to a friend of mine, and she's saying, you know, can you imagine what, for example, a Vladimir Putin could do to this guy?
Yeah,
I mean, all he'd have to do is just, you know, insult his hair or something. This is somebody who seriously, like, becomes fixated over a tweet.
Right.
Yeah. So, anyway, we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm Chris Mark Shea. And we are here today with Mr. Doug Fryer, talking about the debates, talking about other things as well. And in return, you're listening to Red Dots.
Redbox Media now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Doug O'Brien. We're talking about the debates. We were talking over the break about the phenomenon I call Schrodinger's voting booth. It's the mysterious voting booth where you can walk in, and if you vote for a third party candidate, which is what I'm going to do, it turns out that in the quantum multiverse, you can actually vote for, who knows, maybe perhaps six other candidates while you're voting for that third party candidate, because you'll be told, a Democrat will tell you, if you vote for a third party candidate, you're really voting for Donald Trump. And, of course, a Republican at the very same moment will tell you that if you vote for a third party candidate, you're really voting for Hillary Clinton. So it's kind of mysterious.
Well, that getting six votes thing, we invented that in Chicago first. Again, part of our ongoing progressive being a step ahead, you know.
Well, yeah. Plus, yeah, I mean, that's part of that is, of course, because that's where the dead rise to vote.
That's exactly right.
It's zombie politics. It's kind of amazing that way. But I get told that all the time. If you vote for a third party candidate, you're really voting for the person that I fear will win. And what lies behind that, I think, is a ridiculous notion that candidates have deeded to them by God Almighty your vote. They own that vote. It is their property. And if you don't give it to them, you are robbing them of what is rightfully theirs.
Right.
And it's like, no.
The other part of this, I think what I find interesting is, and first of all, I should say Priorities USA, which is a Clinton-affiliated super PAC, is spending a great deal of money right now to reach out to millennials and send this message to them that that voting for a third party like Gary Johnson or Jill Stein would effectively be a vote for Donald Trump. And so you're hearing a lot of this from millennials that I may not like either candidate, but I have to vote for Hillary because it's really my only choice. Otherwise, I'm voting for someone who I believe to be evil, right?
Right.
And the challenge with that, though, and kind of it's not just about, you know, one. I would just say, especially for devout Catholic millennials and evangelicals, is that cooperation with evil on either side is never good. But then especially for millennials, because in many ways this election will set a pace for future elections. And if they do vote for a third party, like the American Solidarity Party, let's say, or one of the other third parties, they do help create then, it's kind of a theme I'm returning to from our past conversations, that, look, a third party has to reach a 5% threshold to get federal election support, right, which they don't have. And without that kind of funding, then it's very difficult for them to raise the money to then in turn compete on an equal stage with the major primary campaigns. So there is something, I think, for millennials to think. Do you want to always be in this binary system where you're given two horrible choices?
Right.
Or do you want to at least begin to create an opening for more than these two choices?
Yep.
Because in the end, the fact that Hillary, I'm actually on the Nate Silver thing as well, is that she's beating him. She's the popular vote. I know we don't do a popular vote, but just for the general theme feeling of the country, is that she's only ahead of him most recently by 2 percentage points, 46 to 44 in the popular vote. And if I was a Hillary Clinton supporter, I'd wonder, why are we not 20 points ahead of him, right?
Well, even Hillary wondered that. really badly advised moments.
Right.
Yeah, she just looked like she was in a flop sweat, you know, chewing out her troops.
Right.
Why am I losing? What's wrong with you? Right. It's like, just shut up. This is really not looking good, you know?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think, actually, if there was ever a time to, one, rebut that argument, that voting, you know, the Nader effect, right, from 2000, is that you're not, in fact, voting for the opposite other candidate, but in fact, you are voting so that you have more choices, right?
Yeah.
And And I want, for example, the American Solidarity Party to do well. I really do. I think as a Catholic, I need a home where I feel comfortable and can actually, you know, get excited. And though I'm not a libertarian, I would certainly support those people that want to help them break, you know, break the monopoly or the biopoly, if you will. And, you know, it's something to consider because in the end, Trump lost the debate, but I don't really think Hillary won it either.
No, right.
There's nothing she said that made me feel more comfortable with her as president of the United States.
Right.
It just showed that he was a bumbling idiot.
Right. And that was really that was my sense too. Was the main thing I came away from that was not, you know, oh, I'm thrilled with policy. The policy wonkery aspect of Hillary. The only thing that people came away with, but it's an important thing that they came away with, was, okay, there's the adult, there's the toddler,
right? And, the man child.
Yeah, he just acted like a toddler, and you just thought, angels and ministers of grace defend us, right? This man wants nuclear weapons, you know?
Right. He had this joystick in the stream of consciousness that would bounce around all over. You know?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it was terrifying watching that spectacle. And so, you know, you just kind of come away from it thinking, I there's so many things I disagree with her about, but at the end of the day, she's a grown-up, and he's not.
Right.
And that's really it, you know? So, and I agree with you. As far, you know, that's why I'm voting for Mike Matarin in the American Solidarity Party. We actually had him on the show on Monday, and nice guy, you know, and I liked him, and I liked their platform. And so, yeah. And of course, you know, Hillary's, this is one of these things where, you know, you make your bed and you lie in it. The reason that Hillary is struggling to make the case to millennials that if you vote for a third party, you're really voting for Trump is because, well, you know, Hillary, that's what happens when you screw Bernie Sanders out of when you play dirty politics against him. You know, the Sanders voters saw that. They're aware of what happened, and now you're paying the piper. You've got a lot of people who are saying, you know, forget it. I'm going to vote for a third party just to spite you, Hillary.
Right.
And meanwhile, Sanders, of course, knows what's at stake, and so he's going, don't do that, right? That's a bad idea because, you know, we really do have to defeat Donald Trump, you know. But the argument that you owe a candidate your vote, I think is absolutely counter to everything in the American founding. We don't work for a politician. They work for us. They're coming to us for a job, and we're deciding whether or not we want to hire them. And I don't owe Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or any other candidate for that matter a thing. They owe it to me to show me that they're not crappy. And if they don't, I don't owe them my vote at all. So that's always the way I approach voting. So I refuse to be shamed by the, you know, you're really giving your vote to somebody else. No, I'm not. I did not owe Hillary or Trump my vote. And if I want to give my vote to Mike Matarin, then I will. Did you get feedback from other people in the bar?
I was actually surprised. The two of the bartenders were younger, I'd say 20 somethings, both millennials, and both actually felt like they couldn't vote in this election. The choices were just too awful. No one really cared about their unique circumstances and challenges. And I think that's fair, by the way.
Yes.
Especially for
millennials.
And one of the, it's funny because I was with a former USC professor sitting next to me, and he was, who teaches on leadership, and he was trying to convince them otherwise. And it was just falling flat. And I think, you know, if you look at the electoral map, where places that like Texas or Oklahoma or Georgia, that Donald Trump is likely to win. I think that's the broader challenge, is that, you know, Hillary is likely to win this election, and she's likely to do so, though, without the enthusiasm of millennials and a huge swath of the center of the country not supporting her. Right.
Right. Yeah.
She's likely to be to win not by reaching 51%, right, and of the popular vote. It says a lot about the country, and again, you know, Donald Trump, in essence, just embarrassed himself. But I'm not sure Hillary did anything to convince anyone that she should be president either. She's just the lesser evil of the choices we have.
Right, the grown up. That was really it. Vote for me. I'm an adult. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. About the debate, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
For listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm Chris Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Doug O'Brien. And we've been talking about the debate. If you want to join us, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. You can also text us at that number. You can tweet us at Breadbox Media. You know, speaking of millennials, all my kids are millennials. And I'm watching them struggle, you know, and my heart just goes out to them. They're faced with tremendous struggles. And, you know, every time I listen to my own generation talking about millennials, they always talk about them with sneering contempt. And I just think, you know, yeah. Baby boomers, come on. You know, we've treated ourselves as the center of the universe for 50 years now. You know, we spent our youth looking at our parents with contempt. And now we're spending our old age, you know, burning through our kids' inheritance and regarding them with contempt. And it's like,
yeah.
You know, it will be a miracle beyond our deserts if this generation, once it really comes into its own, doesn't instantly pass compulsory euthanasia laws, you know, just to get rid of us, you know. But and I look at you know, these two candidates, these guys are, you know, the congealed glop that's left over after, you know, the the baby boomer generation.
Well, you know, it's funny.
It starts to go away, you know?
There's been kind of a political or social bait and switch, right? Is that a lot of millennials were engaged in 2008, right? Mm-hmm. With the Obama campaign.
Oh, yeah.
And rightfully so. I mean, you know, the way I see it is that and many of my Catholic friends objected to me supporting Obama in 2008. And I will say it was difficult at some level for me. But, you know, for me, there are three great national sins, right? Abortion being first and foremost, the slavery of Africans, and then the treatment of Native Americans. And yep. It seemed to me that the Obama candidacy was a step towards at least addressing one of those three great national sins. Rightly or wrongly, but that was my thing.
I think that's a very legitimate calculus.
Right. I think that, you know, many millennials have been disappointed at times with the president and whatever else, but you know, they became politically of age under a president that, you know, you could respect, if not necessarily agree with, who clearly was an adult, who, you know, had a, if you will, a coolness about him. Right. And I mean that in a positive sense, not in a distant way.
And responded to just an immense tidal wave of racism with real class.
Oh, absolutely. Racism. But I'd say, you know, getting the country out of the worst recession in since the Great Depression, the foreign affairs issues of which, frankly, Hillary has get some blame for. And, you know, real immense challenges. And now they're faced with this. Right. So I think our contempt for millennials disinterest is really more about, you know, was that the revenge of the empire? The Empire Strikes Back. This is the baby boomer striking back, saying, you know, sending our least ideal candidates forward, and then demanding that millennials get excited about one of the two. And,
yes. I prefer not.
I know it's, and so you know it's it. Yeah, it's a challenge.
Yeah, yeah, and it's it is fascinating to me. Who was it? There's a Greek story. I forget the story though. All I remember is the concluding line, which says, "Call no man happy till he is dead." And the point basically being, you know, it's not over till it's over,
right?
You know, you can. one of my favorite lines from 30 Rock is Liz Lemon. At one point, is griping because everybody always hates her. She's like the head of the writing staff, and she's just constantly the butt of everybody's hatred and malice and so forth. But something happens, and things go right for her one day, and everybody's nice to her at the office for a change. She says, "You know, most times around here, I feel like Hitler, but today I feel like Hitler in Germany." Right? And I think of that line because it's really easy, you know. You look at somebody when they're riding high, and this is the whole story of politics. You look at somebody when they're riding high, and you think, you know, it's going to be this way forever. And then, you know, almost anything can knock them off the pedestal.
Right, and I think, you know, that there are and I hate to say this, I think that it may have to come from third parties, is that the next generation of you know, political leaders in both parties, you know, apart from some notable exceptions, frankly, are much more reflective of the two candidates, right? Is that in both parties have gone through a process of purging people that are more moderate or, you know, choose the via media, if you will, on policy issues. And, you know, I think it's actually something the American Solidarity Party will have to do after this election, is to begin, if they want to really be a serious political party, is they're going to have to run in off year elections for local offices, right? And explain what they're about and why you should support them. And all the third parties will have to do the same. If they're serious about this, as opposed to simply being against the two candidates that are running now, right? And I think that's the opportunity for millennials to find, again, leaders that you can truly support, feel passionate about, and believe have the best interest in the country at heart.
I hope so. The thing that I worry about with millennials, and it's not really particular or peculiar to millennials, I think it's just something that goes with youth. Is the tendency to look for idealized heroes. You know, I think Bernie Sanders filled that bill for them in spades. Because, there really is something admirable about Bernie Sanders. This is a guy who really is, I think, serious about his commitment to the common good. And he harks back to an earlier generation of politics, kind of an FDR vision of we really can make things better.
Right.
And I think millennials responded to that because, of course, they were looking at two major candidates who, if they're on the Titanic and there's limited space in the lifeboat, you know that they would step on an old lady to get in that spot.
I should say this. I know Bernie Sanders. I've been in meetings with Bernie Sanders, and I genuinely like Bernie Sanders. I also told someone he will never be president of the United States, right?
Oh, sure.
But he
knew that, too.
Right. But I would say this, is that if by some weird, cosmic realignment, he were to become president, I would actually be quite comfortable with that. Is that because in the end you want someone who can inspire people, maybe to work for the impossible, but working for the impossible still brings many more possible things right into perspective. Uh-huh. And I think that a lot of Americans, this has been a theme now for about two decades, is that Americans just don't feel like we have heroes, right? I think it's totally appropriate to believe in American exceptionalism and not necessarily wed that with American messianism. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
I don't subscribe to that view that we're a special in that way. But I do believe that we are generally a force
for royal nation.
Right. We are a force for good. And we want leaders that can inspire the best from us, even with their flaws. Right. And I think they will come again. It's just where will they come from? And that was a big part of Bernie's allure, and I think rightfully so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there were with him as well. There were policy issues that I disagree with him profoundly.
Oh, of course.
But at the same time, the sense was always that you were dealing with a good man, that somebody who really wanted to do good things and really cared about the common good. And that's why he was there was this volcanic reaction to him from the young. And when he lost and when it became apparent that he was cheated against in the course of losing, people had this. He never entered this race with a thought that he could win. His followers, I think, really truly believed that he could win, and I think he never imagined that for a second. But what he wanted to do, and what he succeeded in doing, was shifting the conversation, particularly for the Democrats. More power to him, and more power to millennials who care about the common good. Doug O'Brien, I want to thank you so much for being on this show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer is Ethan Bolin. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and I will be back tomorrow with Mr. Stephen Gradonis. Until then, have a lovely evening. Bye-bye.